High in Fort Bend County and resulted in a judgment for the plaintiff based upon a jury verdict. The case was affirmed by the First Court of Appeals and is before this court on 9 points of error and 2 conditional points. The case arose out of an accident which occurred in the residential backyard shown in the photograph on the right. A 16-year-old boy connected 8 3-foot-long aluminum tent poles together end to end and deliberately touched a power line located overhead some 10 feet higher than required by the National Electrical Safety Code. The line can be seen in both photographs. In the photograph on the right, in which the photographer is looking west, the line is the one that goes off the top of the picture. In the photograph on the left, in which the photographer is looking east, the court can see basically a side view of the power line involved.
Is it undisputed that he intentionally touched it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The basic sequence of events, which is described in this artist's depiction of the accident, is that the boys had put up a small tent in the backyard. Carl Reynolds then put 6 of these tent poles together, end to end, and tried to touch the power line. Unable to do so, he took it down and added a 7th, and finally he took it down and added an 8th. At that point, his friend Eric Everode said, "Maybe you better not do that, you might get shocked." And Carl replied, "I'm only going to touch one of the wires. You can't get shocked unless you touch 2 of them." HLMP's points of error basically raise 5 substantive issues of law. First and most important, does products liability law apply to electrical contact cases? Second, does the failure to discover or guard language of Duncan require a limiting instruction in a contributory negligence issue? Third, did the trial court err in failing to reallocate jury strikes after a nominal defendant collaborated on strikes with the plaintiff? Fourth, is there evidence of gross negligence? And fifth, should punitive damages be reduced by the percentage of the plaintiff's contributory negligence? The overriding importance of this case to Houston Lighting and Power Company and to other electric utilities in Texas concerns the first issue, which is the application of products liability law to electrical contact cases. And for that reason, I'd like to begin with that issue and turn to the remaining issues as time permits or in response to specific questions the court may have about those issues. The question raised by the first 2 points of error is basically whether Texas will become the only state in the country to apply products liability law to this kind of case. To date, the issue...
Why do you frame the issue that way, Mr. Tibbs, in this kind of a case?
Because there are cases in which a handful of courts have held that electricity is a product, but not in a case in which a contact is made with an overhead power line at a point before the electricity goes through the meter, before it is transformed by going through a transformer into a usable voltage. The other group of cases, which are referred to in a brief filed by the Edison Electric Institute as electricity through the meter cases, involve a fairly freak accident in which, primarily because of a defective transformer, electricity comes into the home at high voltage. And there are some courts which have held that under those circumstances, in which the customer is receiving electricity which he expects to be safe, that electricity is a product and the electric utility can be held liable for a manufacturing defect. But in what I call electrical contact cases, which are cases in which contact is made either intentionally or accidentally with a line owned and controlled by the power company like this one, of which, of course, there are thousands in Texas and all across the country. No court has ever applied products liability law.
Well, what courts have refused to apply products liability law in those kinds of cases?
Courts in 13 states have considered the issue, and that includes the Supreme Courts of 8 states. And all of those courts which have considered the issue have refused to apply products liability law. As a matter of fact...
What's the rationale?
The courts which have considered it have varied in their analysis. But uniformly, each court has found that at least one of the traditional elements of product liability doctrine is not met in this kind of case. For example, some courts have held that the electricity, which is the alleged product, has not been sold at this point because it has not yet been passed through a meter where the sale is registered. Other courts have held that the electricity at this point is not yet in the stream of commerce because it is still contained in wires that remain under the exclusive control of the utility. Some courts have held that it's not yet in marketable form, not yet in the condition in which it is expected to reach the ultimate consumer because it has not yet been transformed from high voltage into household voltage. Those courts essentially hold that if it is a product, it's an unfinished product. Some courts have addressed the issue squarely and held that electricity simply is not a product within the contemplation of the authors of the product's liability doctrine. Among those courts, I point out, is the Waco Court of Appeals in Navarro versus Prince, which was a case in which the court considered the issue in the guise of an implied warranty theory.
What are the eight states that the Supreme Court of the state have held it's not a product for whatever reason?
What are the states?
What are the eight states? You said the Supreme Court of eight states.
Yes. The states are Wisconsin, South Dakota, North Dakota, New Hampshire, Minnesota, Louisiana, Illinois, and in a case that was decided only last week, a copy of which we have provided the court this morning, Colorado. And I commend that opinion to the court in particular simply because it contains a very thoughtful analysis of the issue. Perhaps even more important...
Which Supreme Courts have gone the other way?
None. The only court in the United States, to my knowledge, ever to hold that products liability law is applicable to an electrical contact case is the First Court of Appeals in Houston in this case.
Well, now that's a painting with a pretty broad brush. Can I say that again?
The only court with a reported decision ever to hold that products liability law applies to an electrical contact case is the Court of Appeals in this case. Even more important, it seems to me, than the analysis which focuses on the technical elements of products liability doctrine is the fact that the policy justifications which underlie the application of products law don't fit here. For example, traditional products law was developed in order to eliminate difficult problems of proof faced by a plaintiff seeking to prove that a manufacturing defect, that negligence occurred in some remote factory. That is not a problem in these cases. In these cases, the relevant facts tend to be how high the line was, whether it was too close to a building, whether the utility had noticed that work was going on in its vicinity. There are not difficult problems of proof that require imposition of strict liability. Similarly, this is not a situation in which purchasers or consumers are powerless to protect themselves, which is another oft-repeated consideration underlying products law. Unlike a latent defect in a hand tool against which a consumer cannot very well protect himself, the product, the alleged product here, which is the electricity, is contained in wires that are located far overhead, which consumers can see and which they can simply stay away from.
If they know what it contains.
If they know what it contains. And it's our position, Your Honor, that it is a matter of general knowledge that people know that these lines located on poles high overhead are dangerous. There was some evidence in this case elicited by a poll taken by a Houston pollster that people are not aware of the technical aspects of electricity, how much voltage there is, which lines are telephone wires, which lines are power lines. But that pollster did not ask the people he was polling whether or not they thought these lines were dangerous. There's no evidence that people don't think these lines are dangerous generally. And I think, in fact, the court can take judicial notice, as other courts have, that the dangers presented by electricity and overhead lines are generally known.
The Reynolds, in their brief, take you to task pretty hard about not citing evidence favorable to them on this point, and point out that you lost the jury verdict, and they won it. And therefore, you have to review the case in terms of every inference being endowed their way and all evidence taken favorable to them. What do you say to that?
Well, I don't disagree with that analysis, of course, Your Honor, to the extent we're making no evidence arguments, which we are with respect to some points, but with respect to the product liability issue, which I see as a policy matter for this court, that decision should be made by this court with respect to what is good public policy, whether the policy justifications underlying products liability law justify application of that legal doctrine in this case.
I understand. But they say even in that regard, that issues you're raising like the consumer is not powerless to protect themselves, that that's not altogether true here, because this young man did not know the full ramifications of what was overhead, that they say it was not a matter of general knowledge that these were dangerous, that there was a dispute over that. Now, how does that get resolved from an appellate review standpoint?
Well, of course, this young man obviously did not know that these lines were as dangerous as they were. He did think they were power lines, but the question for this court in making a policy decision as to whether or not products liability law should be applied certainly should not be limited to what this one individual knew. There is no evidence on this record, and I think the court's taking judicial notice of simply what it knows about the world would lead the court to the conclusion that the ordinary person knows as a matter of common knowledge that these power lines are dangerous. I think it is because of that that the jury in this case found this young man to have been negligent, because he did not act as an ordinary person would have under the same or similar circumstances.
I'm certainly not trying to argue with you. I'm trying to decide what our job is in reviewing this evidence. They say in their brief that Mr. O'Prea, I believe, or Oakley, your vice chairman, testified that they knew that there were a lot of people that were not aware of the dangers. Now, I may be misstating what the brief states, but there's some other evidence here that they say you are ignoring.
My recollection of the record is that the only evidence on the question of what people know about power line dangers is Dr. Murray's poll, in which he demonstrated that people do not know technically how power is distributed, but didn't ask the question, do you think these lines are dangerous, would you touch them? And the testimony of this young man about what he individually knew. I don't believe that Mr. Oprea gave any testimony on that subject at all. Mr. Oprea is cited in their brief in connection with their argument that electricity is a product which has been introduced into the stream of commerce. That question is a question of law and policy for this court to answer. And certainly this court should not feel bound by the testimony of one engineer in this case in making a decision which will affect not only this case but every other case. The testimony upon which they rely, given by Mr. Oprea, which most of which they elicited, is nothing more than their having gotten him to say, as an engineer, that he considered HLMP's, quote, product to be electricity. Mr. Opria is not this court, and this court needs to answer the policy question based upon its determination as to whether products liability law needs to be applied, whether a duty to warn the public generally of what HLMP contends is a well-known danger should be imposed, either through products liability law or through negligence law. Mr. Opria's testimony simply is not relevant to the policy decision faced by this court. It seems to me, basically, that the ultimate question to be addressed here, both in connection with the products issue and in connection with the negligence issue, which is before the court on a cross point, is whether or not a duty should be imposed on electric utilities in the state of Texas to warn the public about the hazards of contacting overhead power lines. Before the Court of Appeals decision in Reynolds, there was no such duty in Texas, or as best we can find from looking at the cases in any other state. Neither Texas nor any other state had applied products liability doctrine. And the rule of law in Texas was and still is in the negligence area, HLMP versus Brooks, which is a 1960 decision which held that a utility did not have a duty to warn a construction worker to stay away from a power line on a construction site, the existence of which it was aware. It's HLMP's position that no such duty to warn the public generally should be imposed for the simple reason that resources, social resources, should not be expended to warn or try to warn the public about a danger of which the public is generally aware.
How onerous would that be, in your opinion, counsel, to have signs saying that overhead lines are uninsulated, they're very, very dangerous, they do not make contact, those sort of things, particularly in residential areas? How big a burden would that be?
How onerous it would be would depend in part on whether such a duty was imposed under products liability law, which I believe imposes a significantly more onerous burden to provide an adequate warning than if it were provided under ordinary negligence law, which it seems to me, if the court feels a duty needs to be imposed, that's the place to do it. And the way to do it is to overrule Brooks and say that there's a duty to warn the public generally. I point out no other court has done that, and I don't feel that's justified. In response to the court's specific question, I don't have a dollar figure nor any other way to quantify it. But if the solution or the suggested solution is to hand down a decision which essentially tells every utility in the state of Texas to put a sign on every utility pole, that's obviously going to cost some money. And quite frankly, I have serious doubts about what good, if any, it would do. And the best example of that I can think of is this case. First of all, there was no utility pole in this backyard. And second, it is hard for me to believe that any type of warning which HLMP or any other utility could have come up with to put in front of this young man on that day would have made any difference, simply because this young man, and I recognize this is an aberrant situation, he knew they were power lines or thought they might be power lines. His idea was you had to touch two, and the likelihood of any warning ever saying dangerous power lines overhead, be careful, you can get hurt if you touch only one, seems to me to be so remote to provide some evidence that the nature of these accidents is such that certainly a warning on pole, which quite frankly I think holding utilities to a product liability standard an adequate warning standard and forcing them to face in court trying to win on an adequate warning issue in which the jury's instructed that a warning is adequate only if it's reasonably calculated to catch the attention of the consumer in the circumstances of the use of the product. Utilities might feel obligated to try to get something in front of the consumer by putting a sign on a pole. You can't put a label on the electricity. But the nature of the animal is such that trying to warn against it as you warn against a product, I think is quite frankly impossible.
Well, warning denotes commensurate with the risk. I understood the evidence to show, again, I really want to get this evidence pinned down because we've got a jury verdict to deal with. I thought the evidence showed that the young man said that he knew he could be shocked, such as you would be in a normal electrical situation, but that he had no idea that it would be so devastating or such high voltage or that it would burn his legs off, his arms off. And the other boy testified the same and that his father testified the same.
I remember for sure that Carl Reynolds himself gave that testimony. I don't remember, I can check the record and make sure, whether it was given by the other two people. The fact remains that this young man knew he was taking an unreasonable chance, and his level of knowledge, it seems to me, again, is not what this court should be guided by in deciding basically a question of duty, whether it's a question of duty under product liability law or a question of duty under negligence law. Rather, this court should be guided by what ordinary consumer expectations are. And I don't think it's fair to say, and I think the court can take judicial notice of this, that ordinary consumer expectations are that electricity in lines like those in the picture is safe to come in contact with. We would have a very different situation when we're talking about the expectations of a consumer who plugs something into a wall socket. He does expect what comes out to be come out in a safe form. But this is not that situation. And again, it seems to me that a duty to warn should not be imposed on electric utilities because it's not a good use of social resources. But if this court disagrees...
You're only talking about in this instance.
I'm only talking about warning with respect to the dangers of this kind of case.
Because, you see transformer boxes all the time that says stay away, don't touch, that sort of thing.
Because transformer boxes are located on the ground, and if unlocked, can be easily contacted. Lines like these clearly cannot. There was also some evidence in this case that the lady who lived in this house had nothing in her house long enough to reach these power lines. And of course, the more general concern here is, the more common accident is an accident involving a construction worker. They're the ones who are most at risk. And I think it's clearly true that people in the construction trade are especially knowledgeable of the dangers of these power lines. But again, it seems to me, to go back to the point I was making before, that if there is to be a duty, it ought to be a negligence duty so that the decision by a jury can be made in the context of what would an ordinarily prudent utility do under the same or similar circumstances. Because I think, quite frankly, that if the public needs to be warned about this problem, the way to do it is not to have a court decision that encourages utilities to try to put a warning sign somewhere or a sticker somewhere. The way to do it is to try to educate children and other people about the dangers of these power lines. HLMP does that. It's done by other utilities. And imposing upon utilities the duty to exercise ordinary care under the circumstances seems to me would focus utilities on doing the most effective thing rather than simply trying to do something which they could then defend in court as having been an adequate warning, some evidence that the nature of these accidents is such that certainly a warning on a pole, which quite frankly I think holding utilities to a product liability standard, an adequate warning standard, and forcing them to face in court trying to win on a adequate warning issue in which the jury's instructed that a warning is adequate only if it's reasonably calculated to catch the attention of the consumer in the circumstances of the use of the product. Utilities might feel obligated to try to get something in front of the consumer by putting a sign on a pole. You can't put a label on the electricity. But the nature of the animal is such that trying to warn against it as you warn against a product, I think is quite frankly impossible.
Well, warning denotes commensurate with the risk. I understood the evidence to show, and again, I really want to get this evidence pinned down because we've got a jury verdict to deal with. I thought the evidence showed that the young man said that he knew he could be shocked, such as you would be in a normal electrical situation, but that he had no idea that it would be so devastating or such high voltage or that it would burn his legs off or his arms off. And the other boy testified the same and that his father testified the same.
I remember for sure that Carl Reynolds himself gave that testimony. I don't remember, I can check the record and make sure, whether it was given by the other two people. The fact remains that this young man knew he was taking an unreasonable chance, and his level of knowledge, it seems to me, again, is not what this court should be guided by in deciding basically a question of duty, whether it's a question of duty under product liability law or a question of duty under negligence law. Rather, this court should be guided by what ordinary consumer expectations are. And I don't think it's fair to say, and I think the court can take judicial notice of this, that ordinary consumer expectations are that electricity in lines like those in the picture is safe to come in contact with. We would have a very different situation when we're talking about the expectations of a consumer who plugs something into a wall socket. He does expect what comes out to be come out in a safe form. But this is not that situation. And again, it seems to me that a duty to warn should not be imposed on electric utilities because it's not a good use of social resources. But if this court disagrees...
You're only talking about in this instance.
I'm only talking about warning with respect to the dangers of this kind of case.
Because you see transformer boxes all the time. It says stay away, don't touch, that sort of thing.
Because transformer boxes are located on the ground, and if unlocked, can be easily contacted. Lines like these clearly cannot. There was also some evidence in this case that the lady who lived in this house had nothing in her house long enough to reach these power lines. And of course, the more general concern here is, the more common accident is an accident involving a construction worker. They're the ones who are most at risk. And I think it's clearly true that people in the construction trade are especially knowledgeable of the dangers of these power lines. But again, it seems to me, to go back to the point I was making before, that if there is to be a duty, it ought to be a negligence duty so that the decision by a jury can be made in the context of what would an ordinarily prudent utility do under the same or similar circumstances. Because I think, quite frankly, that if the public needs to be warned about this problem, the way to do it is not to have a court decision that encourages utilities to try to put a warning sign somewhere or a sticker somewhere. The way to do it is to try to educate children and other people about the dangers of these power lines. HLMP does that. It's done by other utilities. And imposing upon utilities the duty to exercise ordinary care under the circumstances seems to me would focus utilities on doing the most effective thing, rather than simply trying to do something which they could then defend in court as having been an adequate warning judged by the standards of products liability law. I've got not much time left, and I can address questions on this issue or I can address questions on any of the other points before the court.
I'd like to hear you on punitive damages.
What I have to say on punitive damages is this. Burke Royalty and Williams versus Steve's Industries clearly imposes upon the plaintiff the burden to prove by some evidence, in the words of conscious indifference. And what the court said that meant in Steve's Industries was a decision by the defendant in the face of an impending harm to another not to care about the consequences. HLMP's position is that there is no evidence, certainly no more than a scintilla, on this record that HLMP decided not to care about the hazard of contacts with power lines. The evidence relevant, viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, as I can distill it from the record, is this. First, HLMP knew that power line accidents happen. Not that any particular accident is going to happen at any particular place, but that these accidents will happen. Second, HLMP could have put a warning sign on every pole. Third, HLMP could have advertised on television the dangers of power lines. And fourth, the survey indicated that people are generally unaware of some of the technical aspects of power distribution, how much voltage there is, whether the lines are bare or insulated. But there's no evidence, again, that people generally think it's safe to contact these power lines. Our position is that that evidence, upon which the plaintiffs rely and upon which the Court of Appeals relied, as a matter of law, does not support an inference that HLMP didn't care about Carl Reynolds' safety or that it had decided not to care. To the contrary, there is in this record an abundance of undisputed evidence of care, evidence which the jury could not have disbelieved, that having been one of the major concerns of this court in Burke Royalty, that the jury might disbelieve evidence of care. But there's evidence that was undisputed and uncontroverted of HLMP's, what HLMP did reflecting its decision to care for the safety of people. That evidence is summarized in a graphic, a copy of which we've provided to each member of the court and also summarized in our brief. And I would point out that that evidence, that undisputed evidence of care, concerns not only the fact that the facilities themselves fully complied with the National Electrical Safety Code, which is, it is undisputed, the national standard. But that evidence also related to what HLMP did to warn. HLMP went into schools, HLMP put information in bill stuffers, HLMP conducted community programs, and in light of that evidence on the very warning issue on which the plaintiffs got their judgment, it seems to me that this court must reject the notion that a jury could infer that HLMP had decided not to care when there is undisputed evidence of its care.
Aren't you really making a sufficiency argument cleverly disguised? Is there no evidence argument?
No, I'm not. Because Burke Royalty specifically indicated that in looking at the record, the court needed to look at all the surrounding facts and circumstances. And I don't see how a court, if its attention is going to be focused on was there evidence to support the claim that HLMP was consciously indifferent with respect to warning, which is what the case is about. I don't think a court can ignore the facts and circumstances relating to that decision, which include all the things HLMP did to warn. The question is whether there's evidence. That's the way I've analyzed that no evidence point.
You want us to look at your evidence and not their evidence?
No. The question that the court has to answer is, was there evidence of a decision not to care? And I think under Burke Royalty that the court cannot avoid looking at evidence that is clearly relevant to what decision there was about caring, which was undisputed. If we were relying upon evidence about which there was some contest, which the jury might have disbelieved, I couldn't make that argument. But given the fact that there was no dispute about it, I think it's evidence that the court has to look at, and with that evidence there in the record, I don't think there can be no evidence of care.
You're saying that taking all the evidence into consideration, there's no evidence of an entire want of care.
I'm saying that, and I'm also saying that if you narrow the evidence down only to the evidence that I say is within the facts and circumstances of the decision about what to do to warn the public, and as I read Burke Royalty, that evidence is part of the facts and circumstances that has to be taken into account, that when you look at all that evidence, you cannot infer a decision not to care because there is evidence of care. And my point also is that what evidence, even if you disregard all that, the evidence that is in the record, merely that warning signs could have been put up or television advertising could have been done, does not support an inference of no care. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Mr. Jeffrey Hardy and Mr. James Crowther will present argument for respondent. Mr. Hardy will open.
Hardy.
May it please the court. The fact that Carl Reynolds intentionally touched this wire was the very point that attracted me to this case. As I talk about the evidence in this case, I'm going to talk about a level of understanding of the public in general, a level of understanding. Everyone, I think, has some level of understanding about electricity, but we're talking about a degree of understanding. We're talking about a 35,000 volt line phase to phase, or 19,500 volts phase to ground, in the backyard in a residential subdivision 26 feet above ground. Council has said that these lines clearly cannot be easily contacted, but it happens day in and day out with aluminum ladders, television antennas, poop, cleaning equipment, kites, kids climbing trees. The mere fact that Carl Reynolds touched this line intentionally, in my mind, was not particularly salient. I took this case with the view that electricity is a product. There's no question in my mind that it's a product, and I think the most of the authorities cited by Mr. Tipps support the proposition that it is, in fact, a product. Now, they have fallen off on some other areas. Was there a sale of the product? Is it in the stream of commerce? Nowhere in 402A does it say that it has to be in the stream of commerce. That's to get away from the seller of the product and strict construction of the sale of a product. This is truly a case of first impression, and I would submit to the court, nowhere and no other jurisdiction has the level of proof been offered that we elicited in this case. I want to go through that proof with you, if I might, step by step. Mr. Chief Justice, may I approach the easel?
Sure.
have heard talk about Mr. George Oprah. He's executive vice president and a member of the board of directors. He testified that customers pay not only for electricity, but the poles, the wires, the transformers, everything in the system, but that the independent product is electricity. He says that essentially the service is getting the product, electricity, to the user. Now, council would have you believe that this is a policy decision for this court to make, and indeed it is a policy decision. And that policy heretofore has been one of protectionism. We're going to ask the court not to apply that policy of protectionism to an industry that has knowledge, has foreseeability, puts a product into the stream of commerce, knows that that product is unreasonably dangerous. The courts have recognized that that product is unreasonably dangerous, and that where that industry knows that the level of understanding of the public does not appreciate the danger of these installations. The question was asked, so you've got your poles and all these other things, the customer's paying for the whole ball of wax, and that whole ball of wax constitutes your product. It always has. Yes, sir. Is there a sale? Mr. Oprey, Houston Lighting and Power is in the job of selling electricity, isn't it? That's correct. And we go through the laterals, the distribution system, and the question is asked. So once it's in the transmission line, if it's not sold, what happens to it? It doesn't get to the customer when the customer had to pay for it. What happens to it? The energy flows in direct proportion to the demands of the customer. As the customer increases demands, there is a greater amount of electric energy, kilowatt hours, that are consumed. Now this is important because you're dealing with a unique product. Once it is generated, it's sold to some customer somewhere. It is, in fact, in the stream of commerce. Gets in the distribution lines, it's going to the customer, and the customer's going to pay for it. Is that true? It is not moved to the customer until a customer is using it. Once a customer starts using it, it starts moving across these transmission and distribution lines. Now, how clear can it be that once it leaves our generating plant, it is in the stream of commerce? For all practical purposes, when a watt leaves your generating plant, that watt has already been sold to some customer in the Houston Lighting and Power Service area based upon estimation of demand. Generally, that's a true statement, but not absolutely correct, because you can't put it back and store it someplace like an inventory general merchandise store. Is that true or not? I mean, once it's out there, and it's gone as far as Houston Lighting Power is concerned. Answer, it's consumed at that point. Once it leaves the generating plant, it is consumed. You're dealing with a unique product that's traveling at almost the speed of light. And once it's put in those transmission lines, it's in the stream of commerce. I want to talk about the knowledge of Houston Lighting Power. This is Mr. Boucher, another engineer from Houston Lighting Power. Electricity at 35 or 19 kV is dangerous and will cause death or serious injury of contact. They know that. Houston Lighting and Power knows people contact overhead power lines and that children play beneath them in residential subdivisions. Houston Lighting and Power has superior knowledge about these things. That despite the knowledge, there are no warning signs on poles, on overhead power lines, and residential subdivisions although there is no practical reason that they could not do so. They should have this duty imposed on them. They have the knowledge, they have the foreseeability, and they owe that duty to their consuming public.
Mr. Hardy, how would a warning on a pole help this young man if there was no pole in his backyard?
Well, I mean, whether it's a warning on a pole or a warning that is on the land itself, they can start to put warnings on the lines themselves. They put these big red rubber balls on transmission lines to keep crop dusters from hitting them. There is no practical reason that they can't put warnings on these signs. And there's no evidence here that he might not have seen it on the pole. The pole was higher than the fences around the yard. And if you look at these photographs, well, I've taken one down here, Judge, but if you look at those photographs, it was in the corner of the yard, of the next yard. It was clearly visible to him.
Would you need a warning sign in each yard? Or just one every mile, or how much would you say you'd need?
Let me come back to that just a minute, if I could, Judge, because I want to talk about how they can and should warn. And I'd like to address that specifically.
And my next question will be, how many signs would Houston Power and Light have to put up to meet your criteria of being safe?
And how high should they be placed?
Just enough.
How many is that?
I don't know. Just
well, it takes two legs to walk. How many signs does it make to warn people?
Well, okay.
It takes five to make a basketball team, 11 to make a football team. How many signs does it make them stand?
Let me answer it this way, Judge. When they're going to put 35,000 volts of uninsulated power to somebody's backyard, it should be every place that they invade someone's residence. They should go one step further. They should go to those people and they should tell them that these innocuous looking, there's not anything dangerous looking about these lines. They're just a cable. But they are deadly. If you come in close proximity or contact one of these lines, and it doesn't matter whether you do it with a kite or an aluminum ladder or a television antenna, you are either seriously injured or dead every time, no exception.
How far apart would they have to put signs around the Grand Canyon saying don't get too close to the edge and fall over?
Well, how long's a piece of string, Judge? I don't know. They're the experts. They've got the duty to warn. I say that they should put them every place where high density population areas are exposed to these transmission lines, distribution lines that carry high voltages of electricity, particularly when they put them in people's yards, whether it's in a rural area or an urban area. It doesn't matter. You see, most of the law was developed with respect to warning and with respect to negligence and so forth is archaic. It developed when electricity was first introduced. Now we have hundreds of residential subdivisions, and as a practical matter, they're putting distribution lines through people's backyard. And there are other ways that they can protect that energy. But if they're going to put them overhead in people's backyard, they have the duty because it is foreseeable to them that people are going to contact these lines. You know, if they put a warning sign between each pole, that might be accurate.
You may be getting close to a point that I think legally it's got to be dealt with. You say, normally in product liability warning cases, you just require a warning or you don't. And you don't require it in backyards and front yards, here and there. You just require it. A negligence warning, you require it based upon circumstances. I can't tell which you're arguing when you say at least put it in when